Welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, dear audience. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Micro. As always, I hope you had a great week. And you can always find Let's Talk Micro on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, GoodPods, whatever you listen to podcasts, you can find Let's Talk Micro. As far as social media, I am on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, on X as Let's Talk Micro 1, on LinkedIn as Luis Plaza, and I have an email address which is letstalkmicro@outlook.com. So either via social media or via email, you can reach out with any suggestions, any topics. They're always welcome and appreciated. So please go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, download episodes, and if the app allows you to do so, please go ahead and leave a review. Thank you so much for the support. And as always, if you are looking to learn more about antibiotics, please check out www.learnantibiotics.com and the Learn Antibiotics book, available on Amazon. These resources include cheat sheets, practice tests, games, and more, and they are being used by thousands of people worldwide and may be helpful for you or your colleagues. Great resources from Dr. Timothy Gauthier, a very passionate pharmacist. And as you know, Let's Talk Micro, the podcast, does not have any sponsors, so if you want to support the podcast in any way to continue getting great content, you can do so via a Venmo link and also by buying a coffee, ko-fi, both links available on Amazon. So thank you so much. If you haven't checked out the previous episode of Let's Talk Micro, please go ahead and do so. It was about bacillus, and this time it was about morphology and media. So in it, I talk about different morphologies of bacillus. I talked about some biochemicals. I talked about ways of identifying, like some instruments, some tests that you have to identify bacillus. And I go over some media. So I talk about mannitol egg yolk polymixing agar. And I also talk about polymixing egg yolk mannitol bromothymol blue agar, or PEMBA agar. And these are used in the selection of bacillus cereus in food samples. So all in all, it was a good episode. And as I mentioned, this episode and the one before it that we originally released as episodes 75 and 76. And then now that the podcast has more followers, and since I had just concluded a series about Corynebacterium, I decided to re-release them. That way they could all be together. So definitely check it out and check out the previous one, where I go over, I pretty much give an introduction of different species of bacillus and related genera. So please check them out. So today's episode, I'm just going to be brief. So this is the next episode in the AMR sub-series with Andrea Princey. If you have been waiting for it, here it is. And I invite you to please go ahead and check out the previous episodes of the AMR sub-series. And one of them is about beta-lactams. Then there's another one about fluoroquinolones. And then there was one about aminoglycosides. So definitely check them out. They are always, you know, great refreshers. You know, it's great content. And today's episode is about tetracyclines, which of course, you know, I am joined by Andrea Princey in this series. And we have a guest. And as always, you know, we ask those questions about mechanism of action, intrinsic resistance. How does the CLSI, you know, what kind of information the CLSI M100 has about the tetracyclines. All in all, it was a great episode. It has some great information, so I invite you to check it out if you work on the bench. That way, you know, you can have a better understanding of the tetracyclines, what kind of drugs, more information. And maybe if you already know about them, it's always a good refresher. So let's go ahead and listen to it. Hello, dear audience. If you have been waiting for the next episode of the AMR series, it is here. So I'm definitely very excited to be bringing this one to you. And there's definitely a lot of excitement in the room as we record this, because of course, as we are recording this, today is the birthday of my fellow microbiologist, you know, great person and the co-host of this series, Andrea Princey. Hey, Andrea, how are you? And of course, happy birthday.
Hi, Louise. Thank you so much. I can't think of a better way to spend my birthday than with my microbiology friends. I love it.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure having you here, and definitely very excited about this episode. And of course, you know, when we do these episodes, you know, we always bring a guest. So Andrea here is going to go ahead and introduce our guest. So Andrea, go ahead.
All right. Thanks, Luis. So today I'm very excited. We have a wonderful friend and colleague of mine who I'm lucky enough to work with, actually on the same team, which is fabulous. This is Dr. Brandon Hill. He's an infectious diseases pharmacist and field medical director with me at BMRU's U.S. Medical Affairs team. He received his PharmD from Campbell University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences and then completed his postgraduate training at Prisma Health in Columbia, South Carolina, and Duke University Hospital in Durham, North Carolina. Brandon previously practiced as an infectious diseases and antimicrobial stewardship pharmacist at the University of Virginia Medical Center before transitioning to the industry setting in 2021. His interests include multidisciplinary education and collaboration, implementation of rapid diagnostic technologies, and improving antimicrobial stewardship initiatives in under-resourced areas. And just a little personal note here, I'll say I know I feel like I say this about everybody we have on here, Luis, but honestly, he's a fabulous, wonderful person, very kind, very interesting, very smart. So I think we're lucky to have him. Welcome, Brandon.
Thanks, Andrea. Thanks, Louise. Really excited to be here. It's an honor to be here on your birthday, Andrea. So wishing you the happiest of birthday today. And I also want to take just a quick minute before we get started today to wish all of the listeners a happy belated laboratory week. So just a quick shout out to all of you. Thank you for all the amazing and tireless work that you do. We are so grateful for that. And I wanted to take a minute, even though we are roughly a week late, but to acknowledge Lab Week.
That was awesome, Brennan. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And this is something that it's a recurring theme on the podcast, and I talked about it. And of course, it's always great when we hear things like that. And then sometimes we feel a little isolated in the lab, and we're working, and we get not so nice phone calls and things like that. But it's always great when people take the time and say things like that. So thank you, Brandon. And as Andrea said, it's I have no doubt, when she says like you're wonderful. And so far, I repeat this a lot. It's always great when I'm talking to people from like Andrea's coworkers. Very nice. Everyone has been always so great, very gracious, taking their time and talking micro with me. So once again, I appreciate it and welcome again.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's the least I could do to be here. Really happy to have the conversation that we're having today. And like you said, I do kind of want to take just another second to still express my appreciation for everything that happens in the lab. I'm a bit biased in terms of the microbiology lab with my background in infectious diseases and antimicrobial stewardship. But as you mentioned, there's something when I was in clinical practice, I had this great sense of joy that I would call down to the lab, and I felt like I was BFFs with the technologists and people that I worked with. And so it was really great to call down and be like, hey, it's me. I'm here to be really nice and ask you a fun question and to stop all these other angry people from calling you. So I really enjoyed that relationship that was built within the laboratory because I also learned so much from working alongside colleagues such as you, Louise, and you, Andrea, really turned me into the clinician that I am today. So I'm just so grateful for the relationships that I had.
That's so fabulous. Thanks, Brandon. I love working with PharmDs. You know how I feel about this. Wonderful collaborators.
That is great. Thank you. So for the listeners, if this is the first episode that you're listening from the AMR subseries, I definitely invite you to go ahead and check out the previous ones where, there was one we did about the beta-lactams, we did one about fluoroquinolones, and we did one about aminoglycosides. So I definitely invite you to go ahead and check those out. For today's episode, we are going to be talking about tetracyclines. Brandon, I'm just going to go ahead and ask you, right? Maybe can you start us off with giving a general description of the tetracycline group, maybe a little bit of a historical overview.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to jump in. So the story of the tetracycline class of antibiotics starts in the early 20th century, excuse me, with the discovery of chlortetracycline. This was the first one that was discovered from Streptomyces species, specifically from soil, and this is back in 1945. So this breakthrough in and of itself set the stage for the tetracycline class or group of antibiotics. Just a couple years later, roughly 3 to 5 years later, chlortetracycline was actually approved by the FDA. So it hit the medical scene in the late 1940s. And at that time, its knack for being able to tackle a variety of infections from respiratory to urinary to sexually transmitted diseases quickly made it a go-to treatment, also considering that it was an oral and an IV antibiotic. So that was the late 40s. Fast forwarding to the swinging 60s is where we get the power duo that I'm sure most of the listeners are familiar with. That's doxycycline and minocycline were both discovered. So these tetracyclines were considered sort of an upgrade over the original chlorotetracycline. These were considered stronger antibiotics. They lasted longer in the body, and they fought off an even broader array of bacteria. These were semi-synthetic tetracyclines created. And so doxycycline specifically became a superstar in both animal and human medicine in the late 60s. So then over time, the use of these tetracyclines, you know, specifically doxycycline and minocycline, we face challenges, as we all are unfortunately too familiar with, thinking about adverse effects and rise of resistance as well due to overuse of these antibiotics. When we're talking adverse effects here, just briefly, we're talking photosensitivity, gastrointestinal disturbances, and an interesting one that I'll mention a little bit later is actually the risk of tooth discoloration in children. But I think this background is really exciting. I mean, I mentioned that the first one was discovered in 1945, shortly after it was FDA approved. Doxycycline is still widely used today. So it's pretty amazing to think that the antibiotics we rely on today were born over 70 years ago. A couple final notes, just kind of thinking about tetracyclines broadly. Tetracycline, when you start thinking about antimicrobial susceptibility testing, CLSI, UCAST, et cetera, tetracycline is something that's referenced throughout this. And it's actually because tetracycline is a compound used for susceptibility testing and is not just discussing the broad tetracycline antibiotic class, right? So we don't have a beta-lactam MIC or an aminoglycoside MIC. But in this situation, you will actually see tetracycline being tested for bacteria. The reason for that is that that original tetracycline, chlortetracycline, a derivative was created years after. And that is what we see represented as a compound when you talk about testing antibiotic susceptibility for tetracyclines. Then the most recent history, there were several new tetracyclines FDA approved in 2018. Most notably, amatocycline and arabicycline. Tetracyclines were used to treat and are used to treat a broad spectrum of bacterial infections, gram-positive, gram-negative organisms. They are a niche with atypical pathogens such as chlamydia, mycoplasma, and rickettsia species. And they're commonly employed in managing things like acne, respiratory tract infections, urinary tract infections, and sexually transmitted diseases. So then to cap all this off and to just really hype up the class of tetracyclines in general, there are some tetracyclines that have activity against vancomycin-resistant enterococci, carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter baumannii, ESBL-producing organisms, Stenotrophomonas, and even rapidly growing mycobacterium species. So recognize that that's a pretty lengthy and long list. But I do think it's important to recognize that there's the potential breadth and activity and usefulness of the tetracycline class of antibiotics.
You know, before you jump to your next question, Louise, I just want to say, Brandon, that is a lot, but I think it's really fascinating. And it's, I don't know about you, Louise, but I feel like when we learn about antibiotics and micro, I don't ever, at least, you know, when I was learning all this, I didn't ever get a ton about tetracyclines. You just kind of heard about them. You knew what they were, knew what it included, but I think the history is really fascinating, or all the things they can do is so fascinating. So I'm really glad you're highlighting all that, Brandon. I think that's great.
No, yeah, I agree. And yeah, definitely. And something that, you know, I mentioned before, especially when you're going through a program and you have your time constraints, and yeah, all the time, you know, maybe you stick to things, you know, like vancomycin, and you talk about, you know, you cover your beta-lactams and you barely touch on them. And that's the reality of it. I mean, otherwise, you know, the whole MedTech program will take 5 years to finish because there's so much information. So a lot of this, you know, is definitely something that, excuse me, that you learn on the job. And sometimes, you know, maybe you kind of train a little bit quickly to, this is what we perform. You know, you accept this, you don't accept that. And so definitely not a lot of information goes into it. For the audience, as you're listening, maybe you know that definitely, if you work in a micro lab, you have worked with some of these. you recognize definitely tetracycline. Ravacycline is something that, you know, in my facility, like I also, you know, we use for those carbapenem resistant Acinetobacter and bovaniae. So maybe you're hearing some of these and you're just like, hey, you know, we work with this. So Brandon, you know, you have by now you have mentioned my next question was going to be, you know, the drugs that this group include. And when you're doing your summary, you definitely mention, you know, a lot of them. Is there any other drugs that belong to this group?
Yeah, thanks for that, Louise. You know, I think maybe just to start, one thing that I think is really great about tetracyclines is that they're arguably one of the easiest classes of antibiotics to identify by name. Each of the generic names is going to end with cyclin, so C-Y-C-L-I-N-E. But like you said, we really went through most of, I'd say, the common tetracycline antibiotics. So you're going to see tetracycline just itself mentioned, which is more of a chlortetracycline derivative, really not used in clinical practice, more so used on the antimicrobial susceptibility testing side of things. But then outside of that, just to re-highlight, we're going to have doxycycline, minocycline, ticacycline, aravacycline, and omadacycline as well.
Well, thank you for that, and I love how you made the distinction that, you know, there's the group that's the tetracycline class of antibiotics, and then there's the drug. And, you know, that's something that we kind of see a lot of times, you know, in microbiology, like we have a group, and then, you know, this translates well to when you talk about some bacteria, you know, like you have a group that it's called a name, and then within that group, there's a species that has that name. So that's something that, you know, a very recurring theme and in micro. So, right, I always like to ask this, you know, just about the mechanism of action. And by now we have talked about, you know, we talked about some drugs that target the cell wall synthesis, some, you know, they target RNA, some target, you know, the different subunits of the 70S ribosome. So what is the mechanism of action of the tetracyclines?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So I appreciate that you sort of ended with the ribosomal subunit as a perfect segue into this. So the mechanism of action of tetracycline antibiotics involves the inhibition of bacterial protein synthesis. So to maybe nerd out a little bit and get more into the weeds of it, tetracyclines bind reversibly. I think that's another thing that's interesting to note is reversibly to the 30S ribosomal subunit of the bacterial ribosomes. More specifically, they're binding at the 16S RNA site. So when it binds here, this interference prevents the elongation of the polypeptide chain during translation, and that ultimately inhibits bacterial growth, otherwise known as bacteriostasis. I mention this because there's some debate in the medical community around the utility of bacteriostatic versus bactericidal antibiotics. To think about bactericidal antibiotics, it's pretty easy to reference the beta-lactam class of antibiotics. You know, I think I referenced this a little bit later. Dr. Brian Rowe, Andrew and I's colleague and friend, did such an excellent job. I want to call back to his episode in the beta-lactam podcast that he did with you, Louise, and you, Andrew, as well. So beta-lactam antibiotics attack the cell wall. And the cell wall, lysing, I mean, you have to think if you're absolutely disrupting and lysing a cell wall, that's bactericidal. You are, in fact, killing that bacteria. But in the case of bacteriostatic antibiotics, you're actually relying on the antibiotic to inhibit the growth of that bacteria. So in the case of tetracyclines, you're binding those subunits, you're preventing elongation, you're halting bacterial growth to a degree. And so then as you halt the bacterial growth, you have to think, well then what comes next? Well, in that case, the immune system of the host or the human body, so your white blood cells, are going to come back to try to sweep away that pesky bacteria. So I do just want to kind of highlight that a little bit, talking through bacteriostatic versus bactericidal and where tetracyclines play into that specifically. So with this mechanism of action in mind, I think it's appropriate to mention the development of resistance to tetracyclines as well. You know, I think this is one of the easier ways to really connect the dots between this is how the drug works, this is how the bacteria adapts and survives. So again, calling back to Dr. Rowe's beta-lactam antibiotic podcast episode, he does such an excellent job of providing a very succinct but detailed overview of the various buckets of bacterial resistance mechanisms. I'm not even going to attempt to do the same as Brian, because I just would not be able to do that justice. But the mechanisms of resistance include efflux pumps, ribosomal protection proteins, and enzymatic inactivation of the drug itself. So those efflux pumps eject tetracyclines from the bacterial cells. You have to think about where tetracyclines are trying to interact. They're trying to get into the ribosomes, they're trying to get into the RNA of the bacteria. They need to be deep inside the cell. So these efflux pumps are pumping them out before they're able to get to those ribosomes and bind. The enzymes can also chemically alter the tetracyclines themselves. So this is affecting their chemical structure, ultimately rendering them ineffective. And they do this by trying to essentially chew them up and spit them out into remnants of their chemical compound. Mutations in the target site. So this 16S, this 30S, these target sites can mutate, and then you're actually reducing the affinity for tetracyclines to be able to bind to then impact translation. We also know, unfortunately, that bacteria can swap and share resistance genes amongst themselves through what we call horizontal gene transfer. And then the last one I'll mention is the biofilm formation, which can further complicate the penetration of tetracyclines into the cell wall. You think about things like Staph aureus. They build these beautiful complex biofilm formations that prevent tetracyclines and doxycycline from getting inside to bind with its ribosomal subunits. So this in general, I think, kind of highlights the ongoing challenge for antibiotic resistance. And then also the need for antibiotic use, stewardship, and research even into new treatments that are able to, you know, continue to circumnavigate some of these crafty ways that bacteria are able to develop resistance.
You know, Brandon, I just want to interject here really quick, Louise. Sorry, as he's talking, I'm like having all these thoughts. But I'm so glad that you bring up the bacteriostatic versus cidal issue, because I think it's interesting how that plays out in the clinical setting versus in the laboratory, right? So for the laboratories that are listening to this, you know, if you're new to susceptibility testing, you may notice that the antibiotics that are considered to be static look really different in the lab. And there are certain things you have to do to make sure that the minimum inhibitory concentrations are being read correctly. So as always, we always point people to the CLSIM-100, but there are guidelines or, you know, recommendations in there for how to read things like an E-test, where you might have kind of this like hazy little zone, or if you're reading a well, the general rule for some drugs is, you know, you have to read it at 80% inhibition, but that's kind of hard, right? That can be a little bit subjective. So it can be a little bit challenging with organisms or with the antibiotics that aren't considered to be cidal. It can make reading susceptibility tests or interpreting them just a little more challenging in the laboratory. So I just like to bring awareness to that and make sure folks are accessing resources for how to interpret those, because they can be a little bit tricky.
Yeah, that's great. I really appreciate that context and perspective, Andrea, and that additional information as well. You know, so kind of stepping outside the lab, I alluded to this earlier. There is sort of a debate in the clinical space in terms of when would you utilize a bactericidal versus a bactericidal agent? How much do we really care? We won't go into how I feel about it, but I do think it's important to note that, you know, depending on your institution, your laboratory, and the clinicians there, you know, they might be calling and asking for additional information, or like you're saying, to reread something, Andrea, because they're saying, well, you know, yeah, I have this long list of antibiotics and some of them are susceptible, but I don't feel comfortable choosing some of those antibiotics because they're bacteriostatic. Maybe they work in an institution with a you know, a high rate of immunocompromised patients. So in that setting, you have to think they have a lower immune system. They are immunocompromised or immune suppressed. They might not have the same capacity to fight back. Just stopping the bacteria from growing is, you know, potentially not getting them the clearance and you know the treatment that they're really needing. Now again, it really comes down to clinician perspective, knowledge, and understanding of how much does that really matter.
Thank you for that. And you know, Andrew, I was also thinking that that's something that's when we're training on the bench and we're starting to learn and reading cultures and you know doing susceptibility testing. That sometimes, you know, can be a little challenging when we're learning. Yes, like, all right, so these we read at 80% inhibition and this we do at 100%. So thank you for bringing that to the attention of the audience. It's something that we definitely, you know, at the beginning and, you know, we kind of maybe struggle with it a little bit while we're getting everything straight and can be a little bit challenging. And just, you know, as we're nerding out a little bit, I just wanted to, before I move on to my next question, as we mentioned, the 30S subunit of the 70S ribosome, you know, it's kind of something interesting, especially I was learning about it recently in my class. And, you know, like, so you have the 30S subunit and then you have the 50S subunit. So they don't add up to 70. So the 50 and 30, they are rates of sedimentation when you centrifuge them. So that was something very interesting. So I just wanted to bring that cool fact to the audience. So Brandon, you know, you definitely, when you were talking about the tetracyclines, you started talking about the activity, you talked about, right, broad spectrum, and you mentioned examples of organisms. So can you talk more about the organism types that this antibiotic group treats?
Absolutely, I'd love to. So it's such a broad range. You know, we've gone, I think, in length about some of the potential infection types and organisms that tetracyclines can be useful for. So I'll try to be a bit more realistic and concise and maybe even specific here, thinking through some of the really unique and all-encompassing ways that tetracyclines can be used. But more specifically, I'll actually talk about doxycycline. So doxycycline is arguably the most common tetracycline used. It comes in IV and oral formulations. It's an easy medication to take in terms of it's taken twice daily, typically. Not so easy because of some of the potential adverse effects. But this is not an all-encompassing list, so I do want to make that disclaimer. But a couple of things that doxycycline can be used to treat. So when you're talking about respiratory infections, specifically upper respiratory infections, community-acquired pneumonia, we're thinking about things like Mycoplasma pneumoniae, Haemophilus influenza, and strep pneumo. So doxycycline can cover all three of those pathogens. Stepping outside of that realm, something a little bit more unique, doxycycline can be utilized for Rocky Mountain spotted fever, so caused by Rickettsia species. It can also be utilized for sexually transmitted infections caused by things like chlamydia and ureaplasma. For all you oyster lovers out there, doxycycline can also be utilized to treat Vibrio infections. Unfortunately, that's becoming more and more common throughout the United States. Then skin and soft tissue infections due to Staph aureus, specifically and also including MRSA. And then doxycycline can also be used for malaria prophylaxis in travelers with strains resistant to some of the other agents. And then can also even be used for prophylaxis for Bacillus anthracis, otherwise known as anthrax. So there's such a cool, unique breadth of infections and organisms that even just one antibiotic, doxycycline in this class, can be utilized to either treat or as prophylaxis for.
Yeah, first of all, you know, the oysters, they're not for me. So I'm sorry if anyone in the audience, any of you like them. I just, yeah, no. I like how you mentioned about the skin and soft tissue infections and including MRSA, you know, because that's something that I always noticed. And when I started working in my bench years ago, and when we had, if the organism was Staph aureus, like typically the tetracycline was hidden, but then if it was MRSA, it would release. So hearing you mention that and I'm making that mental connection that, so we release it as an option. This is a question that I always like to ask about, and I always like to tell the audience, please, you know, get familiar. If you work in micro, definitely get familiar with the M100. It's a great resource. You can find it online, free. So when it comes to this group, is there any intrinsic resistance the audience should know about?
Yeah, there is. You know, I feel like we've had a lot of conversation, and I continue to go on at length about all the things that tetracyclines can do. So I think this is a great question to talk about some of the things that tetracyclines cannot do or cannot be utilized to treat. As you mentioned, Louise, the M100 charts for intrinsic resistance are beautiful references. I'm always going to send anyone to that to review, but here I will mention that Proteus species, Providentia species, and Pseudomonas aeruginosa are also intrinsically resistant to tetracyclines. So those are three things to be mindful of. And then interestingly, Stenotrophomonas is intrinsically resistant to tetracycline. So again, not the tetracycline class, but tetracycline specifically, but it's not resistant to doxycycline, minocycline, or tigecycline intrinsically. So there's a unique little nuance that I would like to call out to the listeners.
Oh, that's great. Thanks, Brandon. We always bring this up because there's nice little sections under tables. It's in either, the footnote area or sometimes in the text above some of the tables of the M100. They'll call out specifically how you might be able to infer susceptibility from one drug in a class to another. And I think we always try to highlight this for the medical laboratory scientists on the listening to the podcast, just because those calls come down to the lab a lot, right? Like, I've got this result. Can I just assume this other drug is susceptible? And sometimes you can do that, sometimes you can't. So there are some special notes related to that as it relates to the tetracycline group in the M100. So we always just recommend people take a peek at that if you ever get one of those calls. All right, Brandon, I want to ask you, I'm always just interested in why a clinician will choose one tetracycline over another. And I know this is a little loaded, and I know it probably very much depends on specimen source or patient population type, but at kind of a high level, can you help us understand why you would choose one over another?
Yeah, thanks, Andrea. This is a simple but great question. So I appreciate you acknowledging that it's a little bit of a loaded question. So I'll do my best to paint broad strokes here. I just mentioned I've gone on and on about tetracycline. So, maybe some of the listeners are thinking, well, why don't we use these all the time for everything, with the exception of those handful of things that we just mentioned or have intrinsic resistance to tetracyclines? So it's a bit more complex to discuss one tetracycline over another. But as a steward, I do want to remind the listeners of the importance of picking the right antibiotic at the right dose for the right patient and for the right amount of time. Also, just to say, oftentimes the right amount of time is the fewest days possible. And in some situations, the right amount of time is no amount of time. So rather than answer your question directly, I'm going to kind of skirt around some of this and speak about why someone may or may not select a tetracycline overall. So one interesting thing that makes the tetracycline group so versatile in treatment actually makes them limited in their utility in the clinical setting as well. So tetracyclines have a chemical makeup that includes larger molecules, and they also lead to high concentrations and tissues. So why is this important? What does this actually mean? The larger molecules mean they're unable or it's difficult for them to pass through certain tissues or barriers after they've reached a site. So for example, the blood-brain barrier, that's something that's going to be really difficult for these larger tetracycline group antibiotics to be able to penetrate. Also, when they're concentrating and sort of sticking in those tissues, it means there's not going to be a high concentration of the active antibiotic floating around in the bloodstream to be able to treat some of these more systemic infections. So thinking back to some of these examples that we've already discussed, respiratory tract infections, skin and soft tissue infections, sexually transmitted infections, these are all more localized. They're found in a specific site, in a specific body tissue. And that's why tetracyclines are great choices. Tetracyclines are great. Doxycycline utilized for an MRSA skin and soft tissue infection, that's excellent. It's getting to the skin, it's getting in the area it needs to be. Respiratory tract infections, some of these atypical infections, it's going to concentrate highly and successfully in the lung tissue to be able to kick that bacteria out. However, bacteremias or infections with secondary bacteremias are not really ideal scenarios, excuse me, for tetracyclines because very low concentrations of these antibiotics are found systemically in the bloodstream. So that's kind of thinking through a little bit about maybe when it's good or bad to consider, really about disease state specific. But then also, I want to take the time to mention tetracycline antibiotics are contraindicated. So contraindicated, big red flags in children under the age of 8 years and also in pregnant women. This is due to the risk of dental enamel hypoplasia or teeth discoloration in simpler terms in children and also skeletal abnormalities in developing fetuses. So the tooth discoloration primarily seen in children, just an interesting fact here, occurs due to the tetracycline binding to calcium ions. And then that binding causes or forms insoluble complexes, which are then deposited in the teeth. And unfortunately, these complexes deposited in the teeth lead to permanent yellow, gray, or brown discoloration. So that's maybe a pretty clear-cut scenario or two about when clinicians should avoid prescribing tetracyclines in these populations and also opt for alternative antibiotics if necessary. Last one I'll mention here, it's not quite as serious as what I just did, but tetracyclines can also cause pretty significant photosensitivity. So please, please, please put the sunscreen on, folks. I think this is one of those situations where maybe as a clinician, you would be mindful if you're taking care of a patient that has a skin and soft tissue infection or an upper respiratory infection, and they work predominantly outside in the sun, maybe you reconsider or you do some significant counseling to encourage them to generously apply sunscreen at all times throughout their course of tetracyclines.
So earlier I asked the question about intrinsic resistance, and we go back and I mentioned them 100, and we go back, the typical scenario in the lab that we definitely get that phone call, and for some reason in life, it happens when you're alone in the lab and there's no one to ask, and you might get this request, hey, can you test this drug? Or sometimes the request is fulfilled and you set up the test. And I have seen, things like setting some members of the tetracycline group on Pseudomonas aeruginosa and things like that, and so drugs that are intrinsically resistant. But also sometimes, by looking at this document, we can also find that maybe by using the interpretation of one drug in the group, you can assign that interpretation to another drug in the group. So when it comes to the tetracyclines, can we do this? Can we apply the interpretation of one drug to another group?
Yeah, I mean, this is the frequently asked question list, right, Louise? I mean, these are the questions that you have people angrily calling down to the lab sometimes saying, I need to get this person on this antibiotic, or I want to send them home on this. What does any of this mean? And this is where people like yourself, Louise, and Andrea, and some of the other listeners are so incredibly helpful in ensuring that we take the best care of patients possible. There's another great call out here for CLSI. You mentioned this, Louise. So the Clinical Laboratory and Standards Institute M100 guidance document does an excellent job of providing footnotes for this. I do want to provide an additional reminder here that the term tetracycline is used in CLSI, and it's in reference to an additional sort of version or derivative of the original chlortetracycline antibiotic. Just a moment here. M100 is available free online for those of you that might not be familiar or aware that it's free. My favorite way to do it, I'm sure there are more efficient ways, is just Googling M100 free, and then you can access this as a guest. Organisms that are susceptible to tetracycline are also considered susceptible to doxycycline and minocycline. So I'll say that one more time. Organisms that are susceptible to tetracycline are also considered susceptible to doxycycline and minocycline. So to directly answer your question, if tetracycline is showing susceptible, then yes, doxycycline and minocycline can be assumed to also be susceptible. Now I'll pause for a second to say that there's a big however. There is an exception to this when you're going the opposite direction. So for organisms that are intermediate or resistant to tetracycline, they still could be susceptible to doxycycline or minocycline or both. So I know that's absolutely clear as mud. If tetracycline is susceptible, you can assume susceptibility. If tetracycline is non-susceptible, so if you see an intermediate or resistant result for tetracycline, it's encouraged to then go on to further test those specific drugs such as doxycycline or minocycline prior to reporting that information.
I just wanted to add something real quick, and just to what we're just talking about before you move on, Andrea. So I just want to once again, address it to the medical laboratory scientists, and this is a situation, especially with the that you mentioned, with being susceptible to tetracycline and that interpretation, because sometimes, we do get that request, and I have seen this, and I don't know if the listeners, you might experience it in your lab, but sometimes, we go through this, and maybe we see a note on the bench saying, hey, someone call about this. What do I do? I didn't know what to do. So they say, maybe hold it till the next day, till the supervisor comes in, and I just look at the note and you're like, okay, well, let's look at the susceptibility profile. And you see that, let's say the tetracycline was susceptible. And then, so I go and talk to the tech and say, hey, and I show them the document and say, this is what it says. You can do this, this, and that. And, it saves time. So it's definitely good. And at the very least, there's a lot of information on the M100. So you can read it and get familiar with it, but just know where it's at, know that it's out there. And then at a moment's notice, you can go ahead and access it. All right, that's it.
No, that's great. Thanks, Louise. And actually, while we're talking about the CLSIN 100, there's a couple other things I just want to ask Brandon to just touch on here. You'll note that in the M100, there's several notes about not using tetracycline for any bacteria isolated from the cerebral spinal fluid or CSF. So in many cases, reporting this drug from isolates that are, that come out of the CSF are either not allowed or fully suppressed in the lab. Can you explain clinically why this would be?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Great question. So I'll start answering your question by actually providing, I love quoting. I also think it's great to provide this specific comment from CLSIN 100. So they do provide several warning comments, as you mentioned, for situations such as this. The warning comment here specifically is warning, the following antimicrobial agent organism combinations may appear active in vitro, but are not effective clinically and must not be reported as susceptible. It's a pretty big warning to keep in mind. So earlier, as we were going through some of the other things around the tetracycline class, I mentioned that these antibiotics predominantly end up being highly concentrated in tissues, and they are typically larger chemical compounds. So that lends to their inability or their decreased ability to penetrate the CSF well. So this emphasizes the importance of selecting antibiotics with proven efficacy and safety profiles in the treatment of CNS infections specifically. I would like to encourage clinicians to consult their local antimicrobial susceptibility testing guidelines, contact their infectious disease, their antimicrobial stewardship specialist, their clinical microbiology colleagues to ensure that they're making the most informed decisions regarding antibiotic therapy for CNS infections as well.
No, that's great. It's a really important point. And I think, the nice thing is that often when you get, if you have automated susceptibility test systems in your laboratory, they will come kind of preloaded with rules like this because there's a lot of, downstream consequences of ignoring something like this. And certainly you hope that the clinician is aware, but that's where the lab and the clinician really have to work together to make sure that we're handling the clinical management appropriately.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting when you talk about some of the other antibiotic classes and antibiotics specifically, the agents of choice in certain scenarios will call out meningitis breakpoints. And, as I mentioned, tetracyclines concentrate so well in tissue. So, yeah, you're going to see that susceptibility and think this is excellent. But it's always important to kind of take a step back and think about what's the specimen source of this? What else is happening with the end patient, the patient right in front of the clinician, or the, I'm on the phone with the clinician and they're asking what else could be going on? Is there a chance that they have, sure, they have a localized skin and soft tissue infection, but is there any concern that there's something more nefarious going on from a central nervous system infection before I, encourage you or release or talk about somebody's tetracycline or any antibiotic result? So I do think that just highlights the importance of collaboration between the clinicians, the advanced practice providers, the physicians, the microbiology team, the stewardship team, the infectious disease consult team, your pharmacist, you know, continue on down the line. It's just the sense of collaboration and sharing knowledge to ensure that we're taking the best care of our patients possible, which I think ultimately is the end goal for all of us.
Absolutely. That's great. Thanks, Brandon. So the last question that I have for you is, are there any newer drugs? I think you might've mentioned a couple of these earlier, but I'd like you to, I'm going to force you to pick some favorites. Are there any newer drugs in this class that have come to market that are promising or that the clinical community is excited about? Maybe just got cleared or maybe is in the process. If so, which one? And then what is the drug that you're choosing intended to treat?
Yeah, this is a fun and exciting question. I, you know, kind of in the brief history earlier stated that the FDA recently approved three. There were actually three that were approved back in 2018. Those were ematicycline, aravacycline, and sarecycline. You know, personally, I feel that ematicycline and aravacycline have garnered some appropriate and warranted attention over the years since their approval and even pre-approval, to be honest. Both of these antibiotics have activity against carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter baumannii, or CRAB. They have activity against ESBLs. And they also have activity against rapidly growing mycobacterium species. You know, you said you forced me to pick a favorite here. I think if I had to pick a favorite, and the one that's the most interesting in terms of utility, would be ematicycline. Ematicycline has an oral option, which I think is really exciting when you think about being able to use an oral option for things like CRAB, ESBLs, and rapidly growing mycobacterium that might require extended treatment courses. So we're thinking about what can we do to get the patient home and help them recover at home versus sitting in a hospital or a long-term care facility where they require frequent routine, you know, intravenous antibiotics as well. So if you're forcing me to pick, that would be my pick.
Thank you for committing. I was like, there's like a 50% chance he's going to be like, Andrea, I can't pick.
Yeah. I mean, it's exciting. I do remember when this was approved and there's some really amazing people in the clinical space that I've been doing some studies with this over the years. So it's, you know, the idea of it and its utility is exciting.
Well, Brandon, you know, as the episode is coming to a close, you know, I wanted to thank you for taking the time, you know, once again to be here. But I wanted to ask you, is there anything else that you want to tell the audience?
I don't think so. You know, as we're wrapping up, I want to take another moment again to wish Andrea a happy birthday, to thank you, Andrea, and you, Louise, for inviting me to be here today, for letting me talk about tetracyclines. And I want to thank all of the amazing listeners out there, the incredible laboratory specialists, technologists, on a belated happy lab week. You know, I mentioned this earlier, but this is so near and dear to my heart. I have learned so, so much from working with colleagues like you. And I just really hope that you all continue to share your knowledge and expertise outside the lab as well. I think it's invaluable. And that people through that will start to see more and more the incredible work and knowledge that you all have and give you the appreciation and respect and spotlight that you also deserve. So I'm just grateful to be here.
It's so wonderful.
Appreciate.
Yeah, we really appreciate you. It's really, really wonderful to have you today. And this is an awesome episode and really appreciate all your kind words there for sure. Especially the happy birthday. Really love that one.
Yeah, you know, that is great, Andrea, that you're taking the time to do this, you know, on a special day. You know, like we're talking a little bit before we start recording, you know, I also love when my birthday, you know, like I really celebrate and I love that. So for you, you know, it's really special that you're setting some time aside from a special day and, you know, to talk micro. So that's amazing. So thank you as well. And Brandon, you know, thank you so much for taking the time to being in Let's Talk Micro.
And that, my dear audience, is the end of this episode. I hope you enjoy learning about the tetracyclines. As always, I enjoy sharing this information with you, and I invite you to go ahead and check out the previous episodes about the other classes. More to come, of course, but great information, especially if you're working on the bench. It's so much to learn, so we kind of bring it to one place, explain it as simple as we can, and it's accessible to you. So please enjoy. As always, continue bringing that passion to what you do. It's so important. You do such great work. And stay tuned. Great things coming your way. So, as always, stay motivated, stay safe, and of course, Brandon,
Continue talking micro.
Until the next time. Bye.